Actually, I was a DJ in college.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you know, a college radio station.
Where'd you go to
school? University of Wisconsin. And I had the 10 to 2 a.m. in the morning rock and roll show. I was Kadu the Camel Driver.
10 to 2 in the morning?
Ten at night to 2 in the morning.
When did you study?
It wasn't every night. I had the Thursday. I was the weekend guy, so which apparently was pretty strong at the time, because you know college radio stations really do best on the weekends or late at night because everybody is studying to the radio. So I was Kadu the Camel Driver, driving in the hits.
Yeah, I did the same thing. Had all sorts of awkward hours at the campus radio station. Then I worked in the local. They had one little 1,000-watt hillbilly station.
Mm-hmm.
I worked at that one. And I also was studying creative writing and journalism. And it was funny. I don't know how I found time to do all that stuff.
Yeah.
I think I don't think I'd go back to college and do that schedule again.
Yeah. Well, at that time, you know, we were so much younger, and it was a lot of fun. But, you know, to me, radio, I mean, because of that, and then after doing that, I worked here in New York in advertising for quite a while. And my position as creative director for our company is I tried to get more and more clients into radio. I think it's the most powerful medium. I mean, yes, I was on television today, and I know that's powerful. But I think if people concentrate, let's say, in advertising, a long-term campaign on radio, I think it creates much more awareness over the long term. Now, you want quick sales, go to television. But if you have something that you want to build for a very long time, and you're willing to invest the dollars, I think radio, because people listen to it all the time, whether they know it or not. I mean, so many people have their radio on. I walk through my office, and almost every little office, someone's got a radio playing.
Even the AM?
Hey, you know, people, different strokes for different people. Because, you know, it's amazing how many people listen to talk shows. That always amazes me.
I know. The AM stations here in town are talk. The successful ones are talk and all news. But I went to an electronics store recently to buy a Sony. I was going to get their 10th anniversary special. Really expensive Sony, like $250. And I took it out of the box, and I was turning it around, I was looking for the AM band.
You're
and there
kidding.
Wasn't an AM band. It was only an FM band. So I said, I can't do that. I have my little broadcast goes on about 5 or 6 AM CBS owned and operated AM stations across the country. They're all AM stations. None of the CBS FM stations carry this broadcast.
Hmm.
And I said, I can't buy a Sony Walkman that doesn't have an AM
Absolutely.
Band.
Absolutely. But I think even on talk radio, especially talk radio, if you put in a well-produced television commercial, I mean, it's got such impact. Over time, it has more impact than TV.
Well, I think you may be right in that people really listen. If they're listening to an all-news station or a talk station, they're listening. It's
yeah,
not something
they're listening.
In the background. Whereas,
but even if it's background, I mean, it's still, you know, little words. You know, if you play it right, you'll hear it. Anyway, so just so you know, I'm a radio person. And I'm not saying that because I'm on your show.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Classics Illustrated. When I was a kid, of course, I practically grew up on Classic Comics, they were called it, Classic Comics. And you know, I remember vividly the Last of the Mohegans and I think the Three Musketeers and a number of others. How did, do you have some of the historical background about Classic Comics and how they got started?
Sure. They were started in 1941 by Lewis Kantner. He was a publisher who just felt that the comic books of the time were not doing anything positive for the youth of America. So pretty much that's why he started Classic Comics. His goal was to bring classics to younger people. And that's how it all started. It ran from about 1941 to 1972, when for many economic reasons and also what had happened in the state of comics, the industry of comics at the time, it finally went out of business in 1972.
Well, at some point, they changed the name from Classic Comics to Classics Illustrated.
Right. His purpose at that time to do that was to try and bring them a level above comics, because the attitude in America for comics after World War II started a real decline, particularly in 51 and 52, when McCarthy in the House of Un-American Activities actually investigated the comic book industry. At that time, the best-selling comic books were EC horror books. And,
oh, they were terrific.
Yeah, and Tales of the Crypt.
They were great. The hands coming out of the grave.
Absolutely.
Oh, they were great.
With the great artists like Wally Wood, yeah. People like that. And But they felt that was going to corrupt our youth. And the results of that was the industry started to self-regulate, and they created the Comic Magazine Authority of America. And it had a series of rules and regulations that comic book publishers adhered to. And basically, a lot of people today believe that comic books are pablum for the mind. You know, there's men in tights jumping and leaping tall buildings in a single bound, and that it's really children's material. But in fact, that whole concept really starts out in 1952 when they start regulating.
That's right. They lost a lot of the ingenuity and creativity.
Sure. And the best people in comic books at the time left. Bill Gaines, who was the publisher of EC Comics, he refused to work under these new controls, and if you didn't abide by the new system, you could not get distributed. So he left the industry, and he formed Mad Magazine. So you can see what happened.
Well, actually, Mad Magazine was, I think, originally just called Mad, wasn't it? It was
right.
An actual comic book before it became a more of a glossy book. I have a big collection of the original Mads.
Yes, because what really happened is Mad is an outgrowth of the comic book because, as I said, Bill Gaines could not do the type of work he wanted to do at the time, and he literally refused to abide by the comics code. So then today we have most Americans thinking that comic books are for children, and I can't blame them for that because of what comic books became in the 50s. However, in other parts of the world, like Japan and Europe, the comic industry continued to grow, and material was produced for adults, so that in those parts of the world, comic books are considered literary forms. Only here in America have they really been brought down to a children's level. Now, in the last few years, the comic industry is changing in that it is now growing in leaps and bounds, and our goal is with Classics Illustrated is to take the comic industry and let it put its best foot forward. I mean, the artists working on classics are doing superlative work, because this is a very strong and wonderful opportunity to show people that comic books are just not for kids anymore.
Now, the original Classics Illustrated, you say they went out of business in 1971?
71 or 72, yes.
And who owned it?
At that time, it was owned by Gilbertson, and they had bought the rights from Lewis Kantner, who started the whole thing. And they, I guess it was not profitable. For them at the time, what was going on was not only were comic books being criticized as children's material, but the Classics Illustrated themselves, the old Classic Illustrated, they were under a great deal of attack by teachers and educators because their adaptations were not strong at all. In fact, when we took over Classics Illustrated, our first intention was to just reprint the old classics, and then we realized they were poorly done, and they would not hit the standards that we required today to make them what we want them to be.
Yeah, the artwork was a little 1940-ish, wasn't it? A little primitive.
It was definitely primitive. But the other thing was, regardless of what story was being adapted, whether it was Shakespeare or whether it was Robin Hood or Ivanhoe, everything looked the same. I mean, the artist did not have to draw to a period. The adapters were just quickly, you know, typing them out real quick. I mean, one of the problems that comic books also had was at that time, they were like the sweatshops. People did not get a lot of money, so the best talented people just wouldn't stay in comic books. So today, the whole industry has changed. And through Classics Illustrated, and because of what it can do and might achieve, we're getting illustrators who have not worked in comics to enter the field now.
Now we're getting a little ahead of ourselves. Let's go back just a little ways. There was a period where Classics Illustrated did not exist, but somebody owned the rights to it. And these rights were purchased by whom? Berkeley?
No, what basically happened, as I said, the last Gilbertson had them in 72, and they sold it to Tower Publications, I believe. And then through a series of companies going out of business, other companies acquiring other companies, the rights ended up with the Frawley Corporation, which is a real estate, health insurance, and hospital company in California. They recently appointed a new president at Frawley who wanted a list of all the assets, and he saw Classics Illustrated. And apparently that company had owned them for many, many years, just didn't know they had them. And he knew one person. He had one friend, I believe, who had contacts in the comic book industry, called him up, said, "I have Classics Illustrated." And that person called me. at First Publishing, and I contacted Berkeley because we had done joint distribution and we had done some joint publishing. And to do this job right on classics really required a great deal of money. So that's why it became a joint venture.
I don't quite understand. What is First Publishing exactly?
First Publishing is a publisher in Chicago, and we are the third largest publisher of comic books in America today. And basically, that is my company, and Classics Illustrated is now a joint venture between the Berkeley Publishing Group and First Publishing.
But where does Classics Media Group come into?
Okay, that is the third partner in this, and they will be doing and handling the media, because it is our goal to get Classics Illustrated on television in a very strong animated form. And what they're going to do initially is they're going to create audios to go with the books.
I know Alan Shalick. I know he. I've interviewed him before with regard to the Curious George stories.
Right. Alan was the friend of the people at Frawley, and Alan and I were friends, and he contacted me immediately when Classics became available. Now, what's so funny is here were these rights to a series of books that the entire comics industry had been looking for, and nobody could find out who owned them.
Berkeley, though, is the distribution leg. Is that correct?
Well, they do a lot more than that. I mean, Berkeley is responsible for the bulk of the distribution, the advertising, and the marketing of the books. In conjunction with First, we confer on the editorial content, and we get their input on that as they get our input on the merchandising and the marketing. But they make the final decisions in that area, and we make the final decisions in the editorial of the books.
So First is the actual creator of the strip?
Correct.
Of the books, I guess.
Yes.
Not strip, but books. So you are the one who actually appoints the artist and the adapter, is that what you call it?
The adapter, yes. That's exactly right. I mean, it is, we bring in the right teams to work on the books, and then in conjunction with Berkeley, we select which titles we'll be working on.
And you're the publisher?
Yes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your list. I guess they're coming out this month, right?
They have hit the stands about 2 weeks ago.
Now, are you using the original titles that Classics Illustrated have?
No. We are using many of the titles that were originally published. However, when we do that, it should be clear that these are all new adaptations and all new pieces of artwork. There is a list of books that we consider classics, and in the front of every book, we say why we believe these books to be classics. Most of the material that we will publish is certainly work that has stood the test of time and open one's imagination to a whole series of values and different points of view.
Well, the artwork is really striking. Some of this is really beautiful stuff. I mean, and the format is a little different. It's not the old pulp paper like the old Classics Illustrated is. Just describe the book a little bit to me.
One of the things that we're trying to do is we very rarely refer to them as comics. We really believe these to be books. So in the physicalness of the books, you will find glossy paper. Your listeners will find perfect bound books that can sit on a coffee table. They can be put on a shelf as a library piece. The quality here is unsurpassed by any other publisher in the comics industry.
Acid-free paper?
I don't know if that paper is acid-free or not. I can't answer it, but it is paper that is of top quality. In fact, for anybody or your technicians out there, it is a 70-pound Escanaba. And that is a glossy piece, and it allows the colors to just be as vibrant as they are, as you can see.
Well, some of the artwork is just sensational. It's Moby Dick, Bill Sienkiewicz?
Sienkiewicz.
Sienkiewicz.
Right.
How did you find him? He does Moby Dick.
Right. Well, Bill Sienkiewicz is one of the leading illustrators in the comic industry. One of the most popular, too, I might add. And what we have done here is we have gone to find the best illustrators that money can buy. And as I was telling you a little bit early, if I could backtrack just a little, most people thought that comic books are for kids, and as you can see by the classics, they're really for a much older audience. But what has happened here and what Classics Illustrated has done for our industry is that many of the artists and writers see Classics Illustrated as an opportunity to let America know what can be done in this medium. This medium is not simply men in tights leaping over big buildings and stopping locomotives. There is so much that can be done. And classics, to adapt a classic into comic form is no different than the film industry adapting the same book for a motion picture. It's a different medium, and it has a different appeal. Why I think that the comic adaptation is even stronger than a movie is you're alone with the property. You get to read them, and your imagination can run wild, where when you're watching television or film, you take out exactly what is put in front of you. But here it's a solitary experience, and I think that is something that is just something that today we're losing touch with. I mean, reading is such a vital part of this country. And as we become more and more a leisure society, reading changes from being a fundamental basic to competition in the field of entertainment. I mean, less than 10% of the population reads and buys books. And that's alarming. It's also alarming when you think that America is 20% illiterate today, which means the great classics will really start collecting dust. And for some reason, younger people are just not getting involved in the process of reading. There are many reasons, I suppose. One reason that I would put forth is the fact that when you take a book, it's a very formidable thing to look at if you're not really skilled at reading. So at least through classics, and please do not misinterpret this, we don't want these classics illustrated to be substitutes for the originals, but they are primers. They are good introductions to the classics. And because they're colorful and they're bright, they have a certain appeal that most verse doesn't have. I mean, most verse is black and white, and it's not visually exciting. And I think what we've done here is created a vibrant, visually energetic piece of reading material.
Of course, if verse and prose does its job, you will visualize in your imagination what the artist, the author, is trying to tell you.
Agreed, but the problem is taking that first step. I mean, take a book like Moby Dick. If you're a young person and you pick up Moby Dick, it's 450-odd pages long. It is a tome. It is a volume. It is a challenge. And sadly, most people walk away from that challenge.
Have you read it?
I have read Moby Dick, yes.
I've seen the movie a couple of times, and I've read the book, the Classics Illustrated book. Tell me about some of the other artists that you are using.
Okay, well, as I said earlier, many of the artists working look at this as an opportunity to show what can be done, and we are also attracting illustrators who have not really worked in comics. One to point out would be Gayon Wilson. Most of your listeners are probably familiar with him from New Yorker magazine and some of the illustrations he's done in Playboy, but in actually working in the field of comics, that he has shied away from. He looked at this as an opportunity, and he's doing The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. And if you ever wanted someone to capture the macabre, Gayon Wilson is the person to do it.
Really is. Some others?
Well, Tom Mandrake, who did Hamlet with Stephen Grant. Those are two. One is a writer, Stephen Grant. The other is the artist, Tom Mandrake. They have come on to do this, and they're some of the top people in the field, and they are tackling some very hard projects, and yet, I don't know if you've read these, but basically I think that they're doing an outstanding job. And as I said, and the proof of that right now is that the books have been in the marketplace, and early sales reports are that the sales are gaining speed as opposed to, you know, dwindling after the first week. In fact, the orders keep rising, and they seem to be selling out.
The nice thing about adapting the classics, you don't have to worry about paying the author.
That's true. That's
public domain stuff.
But that will change, because what we're going to do with Classics Illustrated over time is there are going to be two other series that will come out. One series will be called Classic Illustrated Juniors. And, you know, are Classic Illustrated for children? The answer is no. But when we release Classic Illustrated Juniors, that will be a series of books geared for children ages, let's say, 6 to 12. And the subject matter will be something like Tom Thumb, Thumbelina, a different more like fairy tales than some of the classics we're doing now. Then the third line that we wish to produce is going to be called Modern Classics. And those will be classics that are much more appropriate for today's age. Maybe Hemingway, Faulkner, and I suppose we'll be paying royalties to those estates.
Yeah. Now, the old classics, comics and classics illustrated earn the contempt of some educators. Are you afraid of also being an abrasive element with regard to the education establishment?
Well, I'm sure that criticism is going to be launched, but I'm fairly confident that once these educators look at these books, they are going to find a new Classics Illustrated, and they will see it as a tool to assist them in their goals. Already, for instance, in Phoenix, the supervisor of education there in the Phoenix Gazette has commented that he was against Classics Illustrated when he heard about it, but having looked at the books, he's now very excited that they are out. One of the things that's important is we have consulted with Literacy Volunteers of America, we've consulted with RIF, and they've given our editors input.
What is RIF?
Reading is Fundamental. They've consulted with us, with our editors, to understand what is necessary to produce these books in such a way that they can be used as a tool. I believe that regardless of criticism to these books, anything that will get people to read or young children interested in reading is a positive vehicle.
Do you see yourself in competition with Cliff Notes at all?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, Cliff Notes has another goal. We have several goals. I mean, foremost in our mind is to create a very entertaining piece of reading, because it is so important to get people to read in this country. And I think with the colors, with the illustration, it'll appeal to more than just the sense of thinking. I mean, these things have a sense of sight, they have a sense of thought. I mean, they really do appeal to many more senses than just straight reading.
Yeah, I could see a kid going to the newsstand at the bookshop and buying a copy of Classics Illustrated. Cliff Notes, of course, is really aimed to help college and high school students circumvent the task of reading these books that are assigned. They never had Cliff Notes when I was a kid. I don't know whether that.
But you know, the premise of Cliff Notes, though, is completely different than the premise of Classics Illustrated. Cliff Notes is an intellectual discussion on the work, so it assumes that you are reading the work and you're using the Cliff Notes to help you get through it.
Oh, sure.
That's the assumption, though, of Cliff Notes. The assumption of Classics Illustrated is, here are adaptations of some of the great works of literature. Try them. I mean, I suspect the differences between the old Classics Illustrated and the new Classics Illustrated was, if you did a report on the old Classics Illustrated, you'd probably get a C or a D. If you use ours, you'll probably get a B or an A. And the reason I say that is that we have some editorial standards that to all of the artists and writers that say that they must stay true to the original material. Our editor on the project, Wade Roberts, sits there and reads every single script, comparing it to the originals to make sure that we are right in line with what the original master workers wanted done. For instance, with all of the artists, they must draw to the time period of the original classics. And when they and we give them reference materials, we give them costume books to look at how people dressed at the time. And by example, Great Expectations is set in Victorian England. Rick Geary draws in a very Victorian style, and that's why he was selected to work on Great Expectations.
Where does one obtain Classics Illustrated?
Classics Illustrated is obtainable in just about every bookstore in the country, including Walden's, B. Dalton's. They will be available in some supermarket chains, and they are available in comic retailing stores across the country.
So it's also available wherever comics are sold?
That is correct.
How are you pricing these books?
Well, they're priced at $375. A good buy for the money. It's, what is the phrase, popularly priced.
What is the average price for a comic book today?
Well, the average price is hard to determine since there is so much material done. Within first publishing, pricing ranges from $1.95 to $19.95. Just recently, I think DC has released some comic books at $24.95.
When I was a kid, they were all a dime.
When I was a kid, they were a dime. But what's really happened is, in order for the industry to survive, it has to pay better and it has to attract better illustrators. So now in the comic book industry, or at least in the last few years, you're having royalties being paid to the artists, and it is attracting a higher caliber of creator into the field.
What are some of the other comic books that First Publishing is responsible for?
Well, we in graphic novel form, we put out the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We've also adapted several other novels. For instance, we've adapted all of Michael Moorcock's Sword and Sorcery series based on the character Elric. In conjunction with Berkeley, which was a predecessor of Classics Illustrated, we co-published a book called Teen Yankee, which was Harold Coyle's look at World War III. And that was an interesting project because we had a simultaneous release of the comic along with the mass paperback. And that was a very interesting project. But it was that project that the two companies realized that we could work together and co-publish a major project like Classics Illustrated. Also, in First Publishing, we have regular comic books. I was talking about them, you know, the Men in Tights, except we think we're a little bit stronger than Superman. We have Badger by Mike Baron, Nexus by Steve Rude and Mike Baron. And, of course, we did John Sable Freelance, which was on television 2 years ago as a primetime live-action show.
Well, all I can say is I wish I'd held on to my comic books, but my mother told me I had to get all my stuff out of her attic because she was moving. There went my Harry Lauder and Caruso albums and my science fiction collection and all my comic books, my collection of Mad magazines. It's all gone. Somebody else is making a huge profit on those books.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because when we started First Publishing, one of the selling points to get investors was to tell so many possible investors that this was a way to get back at your mother for throwing away all your comic books, which were today valued at thousands and thousands of dollars.
Well, I was struck by the fact that in Manhattan alone there must be 4, 5, 6 outlets for comic books.
Oh,
I mean,
think
I'm talking about not new comic books necessarily, but old comic books that cost, you know, $20, $30, $40, $100, a couple hundred dollars for the old Superman or more.
Right. There's people don't realize it, but within America, there's a chain of about, not a chain, it's a system of distribution that is roughly 5,000 stores across the country that do nothing but sell comic books, new and old. And just recently, a comic book, I think it was called Action Comics Number 1, which was the first appearance of Superman, just sold for $38,000.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, yeah. $100 is not that expensive for a comic book. In fact, one of our books, Lone Wolf and Cub, number one, which is, you had asked about some of our other titles. This is an import from Japan. Our first printing of that book, which is less than 3 years old, is now in New York City selling for $100.
Well, most comic books are really made to be perishable in some respects, and they were printed on newsprint, and they were mostly were bought by kids anyway. Always threw them around.
That's correct. You know, comic book industry. When I entered this market, I said to myself, "This is the strangest industry in the world. They sell product to people aged 5 to 13, and then decide not to create material for them as they get older." I maintain that there are a lot more ex-comic book readers in this country than there are comic book readers. And that's not that the people outgrew comics. It's just that they outgrew the material that the publishers were producing. And what we have done is, when we started our company, was to say, let's create books for an older audience. And that's why we look at adapting novels. About 4 years ago, we adapted Beowulf, the epic poem, which is probably the oldest classic of all time. And we were really, at that time, when we announced Beowulf, we were the laughingstock of the industry because no one was going to go buy that. But, in fact, it's now in its third printing and still constantly sells.
There's no question that there's a degree of sophistication with regard to comics, especially the comics that derive out of the underground comics. Art Spiegelman and his Raw, magazine. It's a terrific example of comics.
Oh, right. There's a revolution going on. But, you know, when you were saying earlier that comic books were really disposable, mm-hmm. I mean, they become disposable because what the producers or manufacturers, or in this case the publishers, thought of their material. If you think of your material as being disposable, then you're going to produce it as cheaply and as inexpensively as you can. We come from the view that America's first exposure to fine art was probably through a comic book as a child. So why should you consider this disposable? If you upgrade it and you put a lot of effort into it, then you will create something that can live for quite a while.
Well, I hope this $38,000 copy of Action Comics is going to hold up. You know, you're talking about newsprint that inevitably is, well, it's acidic, and it's feeding on itself right now. They have to find somebody to preserve it.
Well, you know, there's a whole other industry related to comic books, which is the preservation of comic books.
Which is why I ask you if these were on acid-free paper, because it is just as cheap to publish on acid-free paper as it is to publish on acidic paper.
This could be. I just really don't know technically.
I have a little pin, a device.
That tells you?
Yeah, you just put it on the edge, and if it turns purple, it's acid-free.
Right. Well, there's
And in fact, you can put it on. You can try it out on toilet paper. Sometimes your toilet paper is acid-free paper.
So actually, most toilet paper is newsprint and comic book paper. I mean, old comic books, you know, crushed, mollified, dyed, and most Kleenex and toilet paper comes mostly from newspapers.
But nevertheless, I don't know if that would be considered acid-free. It's just, it's like Russian roulette. You don't know because so many paper mills are now using acid-free paper. But they have to do some conversion somehow, but it can be done just as cheaply. So you don't know what's really coming out. So that's why I'm saying that sometimes you can get toilet paper that's acid-free.
Yeah, you're probably
right. And a book that you've spent $100 for that's not.
Well, you know, for instance, I happen to know that in Chicago there is a company, I think it's called Comic Covers, and they produce boxes and plastic bags that are acid-free boxes and plastic materials to put the comic books in, and then you put them in boxes, and then you preserve them for 100 years, and hopefully you'll have something worth $38,000.
Well, that's a way to protect them. I'm not sure that's going to protect the magazine itself, because the acidic nature feeds upon itself.
You mean, and so it gets brittle and breaks.
It gets brittle even within an acid-free container. That's still good to protect it. My best books I always put in... it's not really plastic. It's something like Mylar that I order from a library supply house.
Right.
And I put my dust jackets on my best books in there because a lot of the books I have are deteriorating. Just on the shelf, you could see they're turning yellow and brittle. And you don't want that to happen. So the comic books are even more perishable. When you
absolutely
think about it, just simply because of the nature. However, these pages look good. I mean, this is... quality stuff. These are really beautiful. The artwork is just gorgeous on these. I wish you the best on this, Rick.
Thank you very much.